Hello, it's Stuart Henderson. I'll come up.
Doors opening. Ground floor.
Right, where are we? 14th floor. There we go.
Doors closing.
I've come to this block of flats, one of five in the Sefton Park area of Liverpool. The blocks of flats are a remnant of tower blocks still left standing from the 1950s and 60s. When I left Liverpool in 1973, there was anything upwards of 70 residential tower blocks. Now, there are barely a dozen. But these ageing tower blocks, which are left, are proof that high-rise living does not necessarily mean the urban cliché of decaying, windswept, joyless estates where the lifts don't work. This one certainly does.
Doors opening. 14th floor.
Hiya, Chris. Hiya. Can I come in?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm smashing.
No problem.
Oh, lead me through.
There you
wow.
go.
Wow, an amazing flat, isn't it? Full of light. If we can just go out onto your balcony. Yeah. It's an extraordinary view you got from here, isn't it? Sort of this huge sweep of Liverpool. You can actually see North Wales.
That's right.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's nice New Year, bonfire night, and you see all the fireworks all the way around. It's lovely in the summer. It's absolutely warm.
They are beautifully decorated now, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, considering what Liverpool tower blocks used to be like.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, Chris, scanning the city from here, you can see how very few tower blocks are actually left. When I was growing up in Liverpool in the 50s and 60s in the Anfield area, I remember the tower blocks at nearby Sheil Park being built. They struck me at the time as these plain, unattractive mammoths, but they did have a huge presence on the skyline. When I went back recently, there was no trace of them. I wanted to find out why this particular chapter of social housing was relatively so short-lived. As in cities all over Britain, the tower block began as a grand municipal scheme that offered a radical solution to the post-war housing crisis.
During the dozens of air raids on Liverpool in the first couple of years of the Second War, there were 10,000 homes completely destroyed and a fair proportion of the centre of the city laid waste, incidentally, and nearly 200,000 homes damaged.
Liverpool's problem was particularly acute. Pre-war, the city reluctantly paraded some of the worst slums in the country. Streets of Victorian back-to-backs, tenement flats and narrow court houses, many a hangover from the mid-19th century when Liverpool had to accommodate an enormous influx of Irish immigrants fleeing the ravages of the 1840s famine. Following the pummeling delivered by the Second World War, it became imperative to find quick solutions.
In 1951, the then director of housing reported that the population of about a million, I think, at the time, a fifth of them were on the housing list awaiting new dwellings. 11,500 families still living in overcrowded, insanitary conditions, not incomparable with those of the mid-19th century. And in fact, there were even a few of those mid-19th century dreadful courts still around.
Cultural commentator Peter Maloney. National attention became focused on the shocking state of the housing stock. And in 1954, the government launched a great drive to get rid of the slums. It offered subsidies to large authorities like Liverpool to build upwards. Walter Baur became Liverpool's chief planner in 1962.
The problem was this mass of high-rise buildings had an instant appeal to the politicians who could point to a certain area and say, look, this is what I've done. People who were anxious to have new homes were only too happy to move into any of these tower blocks. The social consequences were not apparent yet, and people were simply glad to have a new roof over their head. And so it was very difficult to get the public to see the potential dangers of this kind of housing policy.
It certainly does seem that the pioneering high-rise tenants were grateful to be rehoused. And a little note for the snag list. The screech you'll hear on this next bit of archive is not a technical fault, but a pet bird voicing its democratic right.
Well, Mrs. Badham, you're an old age pensioner.
Yes.
How long have you lived here?
4 years.
3 years in July.
You find this a friendly place?
Oh, yes, very.
Well, now, you live in a very high flat. How many stories up?
Six.
Do you mind living so high?
No.
What do you like about your flat?
Well, it's all convenient, and it's... And the doctor said that I was to have a place on the level. I couldn't do the stairs, you know.
You've got a lift here.
We got a lift. Mm.
Well, it looks a very nice little flat to me. Anything you dislike about it?
I don't dislike anything about it. I like it. I like it all, and I've made myself comfortable, and I wouldn't like to go now.
The opening of the first tower blocks in Liverpool certainly attracted positive press coverage. Steve Binns is community historian for Liverpool Council.
If you go back to the papers and on the day, say for Entwistle or Heights or one of the blocks, one of the problems is that most of them opened before voice recordings were taken. But it does seem that they could always find someone who was happy about being taken into a sparkling new flat or house. They would have a picture of the interior. They would have a picture of the walkways or the green space in front. They would sometimes have young families, but going back to the records, it wasn't usually them they discussed it with. It was usually people in the 50s and 60s and 70s who were generally hopeful. But they didn't really need to persuade people of what they were going to do anyway.
Steve Binns prompted me to burrow through the newspaper archives at Liverpool Central Library, and there I found descriptions of the 10-floor showpiece Coronation Court, one of the earliest tower blocks. Opened by the Conservative Minister of Housing, Duncan Sands, at the end of September 1956, the show flats at Coronation Court were catwalked by the then Liverpool Corporation as an aspirational dream. The Evening Express on Friday, October 5th, 1956, reported... Starting with the bedroom.
There is a contemporary divan and a light oak suite.
Moving into the spacious living room.
The three-piece suite is a grey wool moquette piped with cherry.
And what about the engine room of every home?
The electric cookers are every housewife's dream. The one in flat number 6 has an inner glass door.
It must have been, I was about 8, and I can remember my parents talking about it, because we lived in a terrace house in Winslow Street, and it was Mother's dream that she would have loved to have an indoor bathroom.
Chris Williams remembers being taken to look at one of the new high-rise show flats in Fazakerley.
In our street, we were one of the few people in that time who actually owned a car, and Sunday was a day we'd have a run out in the car, and this was a big thing. And I remember getting there and going in a lift and thinking to myself, oh, great, you know, I can't wait to get back to school and say, well, we're going to live in a house where you get a lift to, you know, really brag to my mates. And then when we got up to the floor where the show flat was, and the thing that struck me quite vividly was how warm it was, because my home in Winslow Street was just like all other houses in the area. It was all coal fires. And to have central heating, well, you know, great, you know, a sort of posh factor. And next thing I remember was my mother's face, because she was basically gobsmacked to see the kitchen. It was a lovely, you know, fitted kitchen. It had units in it. And then we were shown through to the bathroom with a, you know, indoor toilet. And it was just quite an experience.
Josie Crawford also remembers her first impressions of moving into a new flat in Shiel Park with her mother.
For me, walking in there, it was like an American hotel. And I remember she thought it was just gorgeous, but it was brand new. It was all modern stuff, because we got new suites and new carpets, and she had this sideboard, it was like a coffin.
It's almost impossible now to imagine the intoxicating vigour and optimism which permeated the 60s. There were jobs on tap and Ford Anglias to purchase and customise. To quote poet Brian Patton, it was a land of giant hoorays. Well, now you shake it to the left, you shake it to the right, you do the hippie shake-shake with all of your might, oh baby, yeah, come on, shake. The national imperative to clear vast tracts of bomb-damaged slum housing had given planners the authority and scale they'd only dreamed of before the war. a revitalization of entire cities where speed was of the essence.
We have to face the fact that far too much of the industrial north looks like hell, and we have to build 10 times as fast if we're going to make any real impact.
We're 25 years behind events. I think we need to reinvent the city.
The very first thing we had to do, as you can imagine, is to get together a team to set about discovering the essence of the place, discovering the permanent characteristics. Although Liverpool has some of the finest collection of 19th century buildings, it's also got the worst collection of 19th century slums. And this is a result of the fact that Liverpool had its building boom 100 years ago. So now it's Liverpool's turn for renewal. The cycle of renewal has come round, and it comes round at least once in every century for every great city.
Graham Shankland, who was consultant planner to Liverpool City Council in the early 60s, and the voices of Lewis Womersley and Wilfred Burns, who were similarly shaping Sheffield and Newcastle. The major cities had grand schemes. T. Dan Smith, the infamous leader of Newcastle City Council, declared that Newcastle would be the Brasilia of the North, a city free and beautiful. In the collective nirvana, there was to be a sweeping away of the tangle of gloomy and outdated Victorian streets and terraces.
This is Liverpool. Liverpool with the gloves off. It has accepted the challenge of a complete motor age reconstruction. The whole city is like a tired old queen of the music halls, pockmarked and scarred, but still preserving the pride and the dignity of her heyday long since past. The Mersey beat echoes from the basement clubs through the derelict streets like a cry from the heart, a call to action, a relentless affirmation in the life of the city.
John Donat, reporting on the changes to Liverpool City Centre in a documentary made in 1964. By this time, there were no less than 250 redevelopment schemes in operation throughout the country. But the tower blocks didn't stand easily within these plans. Miles Glendinning is an architectural historian who specialised in the history of public housing.
The planners, the sort of municipal reconstruction visionaries of the late 50s and 60s, and people like T. Dan Smith or Graham Shankland, or especially just about anybody in the London County Council, especially people like Shankland, who was a communist, you know, the 20th century, the social era, had to above all sweep away the kind of mixed together laissez-faire 19th century legacy, and that was the physical legacy, the social legacy, the economic legacy. So their vision was for comprehensive replanning. Now, the tower blocks that you see that were actually built were mainly built by the housing local politicians who were mainly at daggers drawn with these planner visionary people. People nowadays have to understand that the post-war city was not an arena of a kind of grand Soviet-style monolithic development process by a single group of people. It was the site of a continuous rolling war between the advocates of comprehensive replanned solutions and the municipal bunging of blocks onto individual sites as and when they came up, production people.
In 1964, the Labour campaign led by Harold Wilson carried with it the promise of a socialist revolution.
Under the Tories' policies and Tory preachings, you have found in this country the verb to have come to mean so much more than the verb to be. So on October 15th, we're appealing to you not only to get new measures and new policies and new men, but to get a sense of social purpose and a new scale of social values in this country of ours.
Once in power, the new Labour government embarked on one of the largest building programmes that had ever been launched in the non-communist world. To keep up with demand, building firms were being awarded huge contracts to erect blocks like Meccano. Miles Glendinning again.
Very often the way that the ordering of these huge housing drives was approached was like going on a shopping trip, particularly in Birmingham, where historical research into the Birmingham programme revealed that the head of the housing committee actually went to on a kind of delegation to see some particular blocks, and he said, you know, right, we'll have X number of these and X number of these, just as if he was buying bags of sweets. I think that's what the city architect in Birmingham recalled, you know. I mean, I'm sure the Liverpool was exactly the same.
As politicians were caught up in the fervour of technology, Little consideration had been expended on the council tenants who had over the last decade been moved out of the old inner city areas to the tower blocks and new towns on the margins. Michael Barrett, in a Panorama report in 1964, asked this Liverpool woman about moving up to the new flats at Everson Heights.
How long have you lived here?
All my life.
How will you feel about being moved away?
Well, I'll feel very upset for the moment, but I'll get used to it by and by.
Do you think you could get used to living in these new flats at Everton Heights?
No, I don't like them, and I wouldn't go. I told you where I'd remain, didn't I?
No, tell me now.
In the toilet, in the lavatory, with the little table there.
Why, are you so happy here?
Yes, I'm happy in the neighbourhood, where you wouldn't find that anywhere else in them flats.
Dolly Lloyd's mother felt much the same when she was offered a new flat.
My mother got this offer, and she had to go and look at the flat. And she said, I've been down, she said, to down the town. She said, and no way am I going to live in the sky, no way. So I said, what do you mean up in the sky? She said, tower blocks. She said, so that's what they can only give us.
A fella from the council who's just left planning school has told us that we're being moved right out of Liverpool. Don't want to go to Kirby or Skemmersdale or Speak. Don't want to go from Morbino and back Buchanan Street. We'll miss a lot of little things like putting out the cat, for there's no back door in the 14th floor of a unit commerce flat.
Don't people have got to realise what it's like to live on the ground and to go up in the sky. You had a wonderful view. Oh, you could see right across the Mersey, you know, and all that, you know. But that wasn't it. You were missing out on real life, being close to people.
Pre- and post-war Liverpool was in part a segregated city, not in an obvious and evident way, but if you lived there, you knew what you were, Catholic or Protestant, orange or green, King Billy or the Pope. You could opt out, as I did, and join the artistic dissenters, but sectarianism was hard to escape when often your surname indicated the colour of your bonnet. In the slum clearances, Catholic Scotland Road and Protestant Everson had been flattened and their communities moved to the tower blocks. Maureen O'Brien, who is now an actress and writer, remembers travelling home on the bus from her Catholic school.
I have this vivid picture of sitting up there on the top of the bus. On my left, streets of little back-to-back red brick Victorian houses, and on the right-hand side of the bus, these huge high-rise flats, like a great wall, all clean-looking and white, I remember, and rows and rows and rows of windows going up into the sky. And what I remember about going through these were the orange and purple curtains. There was the occasional window with a picture of the Pope or a picture of the Sacred Heart or something like that. But mostly it was orange and purple curtains and slogans written up on the wall. King Billy lives. Long live King Billy. To hell with popery. And I was on a bus once going along there, and there was a little kid swinging his legs and singing quietly to himself, to hell with pokery.
By now, tower blocks were part of the national psyche. The gritty realism of BBC Television Z-Cars was set in fictional Newtown, based on the Liverpool modern high-rise development of Kirby. And the characters from the children's programme, Mary, Mungo and Midge, peered out from the windows of a top-floor flat. Then, in 1968, a system-built block called Ronan Point in London became a front-page story when a tenant put her kettle on the gas cooker and the resulting explosion killed five people.
Now, what I have done is to assemble a team of experts from the Ministry of Housing, the Ministry of Works and Buildings, and the Ministry of Power, and any other ministry who may be...
James Callaghan, who was Home Secretary. Ronan Point was significant for the Tower Block because it dramatically changed public opinion.
That's really quite a kind of egregious example of how, in England in particular, the housing debates are structured in a kind of highly polarised and very rapidly fluctuating way. Because of this sensational incident, you went almost overnight from a complete acceptance of the overriding necessity of building millions of tower blocks up and down the country, support by local political groups, to a sudden, complete rejection, the movement being disowned politically, and the Conservative Party sensing a potential advantage in the local elections coming up soon after that, immediately pledged to sort of abolish multi-storey flats and up and down the country, or stop building them. And there was a complete turnaround, within a year. So, yeah, Ronan Point was the sort of focus for the housing polemic system in Britain at work.
In BBC Radio Merseyside's archive, I came across a report of a smaller gas explosion at some high-rise flats in Bootle in 1974. 90 families had been evacuated, and it illustrates how frightened tenants had become.
I don't want to go back.
Why is that?
Because for the simple reason they're putting gas back into the flats. And the corporation should have took the warning from Ronan Point, and I've said this over and over again, they should have took the gas out. They should never have been put in these multi-storey blocks.
But you do realise there'll probably be a bit of a problem finding accommodation for you with a family.
True, there could be, but I still don't intend to go back.
But of course it's at a time when something like the Mersey House incident strikes a high-rise block of flats that the spotlight also gets turned on the everyday drawbacks of life in the tower blocks.
But we were trying to get out. We put our name down for a transfer, to move. Because there was no way for the children to play, To me it was like the children were imprisoned.
The plight of children in the blocks had prompted Marjorie Gallimore to motivate residents to become more vocal. She now has an MBE for her years of campaigning for the rights of tenants, but still remembers the key preoccupations when she herself was bringing up a family in Chilwall Heights 40 years ago.
It just wasn't right at all that little ones should be in tall flats. And that was one of our first issues that we tackled.
Was that because there was nowhere for the children to play?
Yes. And the danger of balconies. Mothers were on edge all the time because the windows didn't lock. And there was always that danger somebody was going to go over.
Were there other issues that started to manifest themselves? Problems with the flat?
Yes, dampness. How my two daughters slept in the bedroom they had, I'll never know. Was green mould up the wall, and it's so damp.
Did you contact the council about
this? Yes.
And what was their response?
Condensation, they said. One visitor even told me it was my electric kettle causing it.
Oh, right, so it was your fault.
It was my fault.
It was nothing to do with the actual materials that the buildings were...
No, and then he said, well, it's your washing machine. I said, I haven't got a washing machine.
Tenants felt they could no longer trust the council.
No, we had to go and really see what was written down. And on many occasions, we went to Parliament about things, and all the Liverpool MPs would put a room aside to see us, and we got a lot of things done that way.
As public enthusiasm waned, politicians, planners and builders realised that the future was a return to ground level.
Lewisham Council was one of the first to change course, and much of the initiative came from ebullient Nicholas Taylor, now chairman of the planning committee.
We can all argue over the beauties of architectural detail, but what matters in the first place is to get the basics right. And the basics are, a contact with the ground. People want the small scale, the little intricate scale of the fence and the gnome and the garden path and two steps up to the front door and the detailing of the door handle and the letterbox. And all these things, they matter so much.
But major cities such as Liverpool were littered with the legacies of a social housing experiment that was now virtually considered defunct. As conditions in the tower blocks began to worsen, it was the church's leaders who took note that their communities were being abandoned and were forced to articulate their frustration through vandalism. Here's Catholic Archbishop, the late Derek Warlock, talking about the Queen's visit to Liverpool in 1984.
The Queen was up here visiting one of the outer estates, and we were having to explain to her why a whole big block of buildings had apparently no tiles which could let in the rain on the people. And we had to explain to her that the people had themselves destroyed their roofs in order to render their housing uninhabitable, in order to get rehoused, because they had totally rejected the quality of the building in which they had been placed.
In the spring of 1985, I interviewed the Anglican Bishop of Liverpool, David Shepherd, at his official residence in the sandstone suburb of Walton. As we stood outside afterwards and gazed down on the disintegrating jumble of shoeboxes that was the Netherley estate, the late bishop gestured towards it and said, "That is my daily meditation." That same year, Chris Searle visited Netherley. Built as a deck access scheme with walkways outside the building, it was long rather than tall. Anyone in the know called it Alcatraz. Here is part of his report for Radio 4.
There's no public lighting. There's rubbish and glass from the broken windows everywhere, and a depressing smell of decay. In the cold moonlight, it looked like a ghost town, but incredibly, among the blacked-out and boarded-up flats, there were a few lighted windows, three or four in each block, and one of them, on the ground floor, turned out to be the Citizens Advice Bureau. I'd have thought the best advice would be to leave, but I was welcomed by the Netherley CAB organiser, Charlotte Anderson. Just to see what conditions the people still living there have to put up with, she took me up into one of the unlit corridors.
Now imagine living along here. It's just unbelievable, isn't it, that you'd have to come along here to go home with an empty flat.
This is a colossal development, isn't it? How many people would have lived here?
Well, it was 3,500 dwellings originally. And it's a mile-long spinal block, which...
Is that a stray dog sitting there?
No, somebody lives there.
Oh, somebody lives there.
But it's live
no,
well?
It's boarded up, that one.
No. No, that one, they've just broken the glass, but somebody lives in there.
Well, they can't live in there. The window's boarded up and there's sheets of corrugated iron.
This is a You shouldn't go near the door.
This is the downstairs toilet. I'll have to light the candle because the bulb won't work right.
Why doesn't the bulb work?
Because the socket's blown with the damp. Here, all the paper's peeling off the wall, as you can see.
The paper's completely come off the wall. Okay, upstairs. No carpet on the floor, just concrete steps. No carpet because of the damp again.
Damp, yeah. This hole in the wall here, I think that's where the rat came from.
But you actually had a rat in the flat?
Yeah, it was in my son's bed. I found it in my son's bed. I killed it and the man from the health come and collected it. Oh.
Now, what's this, one of the bedrooms?
This is the front bedroom. This used to be my son's bedroom.
Oh, that smells horrible. But it's difficult to see in the evening, just by candlelight, but...
Yeah, I had to throw the quilt away. Because it was green mouldy, and I'm going to have to throw these two beds away.
Because they had green mould. They had green mould.
Green mouldy at the side. Yeah. So we moved my son from this bedroom to the back bedroom. Excuse the smell again.
Oh, it's horrible. Mm. That's great. Sort of thick. Hold the candle over here for a moment. Yes, it's just. Yes,
don't
you can rub it off
your
with
face
your finger.
Because you might get a rash.
Where's all the water coming from?
From next door. A lot of it's coming from next door because that's flooded and no one's been in to do anything about it. Plus, I've had my gas turned off because they say it's dangerous, it can't be fixed. So I am now cooking on two electric rings and I'm using two electric fires to keep the living room warm.
That must be costing you a lot to run.
My bill is £500 now.
What happens when you complain to the council about it?
Well, they just say, well... You know, there's nothing that can be done. There's no way for you to move. And there's a lot of people worse off than what you are. And I mean, if there's people worse off than me, then all I can say is God help them.
By the early 90s, the housing situation was critical. Harry Rimmer was the leader of the council at the time. I asked him how much it would have cost to do the repairs.
we calculated, we didn't over-egg it either, we calculated conservatively that Liverpool Council needed to spend over a billion on the housing stock. That's the housing stock as a whole, not just the high-rise, of course. You see, one of the situations that was caused by the state of affairs was that we had thousands, literally 3,500 dwellings, empty, vacant, because of their poor state of repair and maintenance.
Following the Toxteth riots in the early 80s, when he was appointed Minister for Merseyside, Michael Heseltine had made a strong commitment to Liverpool. He suggested a Housing Action Trust, which was the Conservative model for council housing opt-out, and eventually Liverpool Council agreed to hand over responsibility for all the tower blocks. Now, why did you take that course of action as council leader? Because there you were, a Labour leader, committing to a Conservative government initiative, thereby saying your council wasn't up to the job.
Because I was desperate to get some relief into the poor housing conditions, I think it was assumed that something, you know, unusual was going to have to happen. We'd reached complete stalemate on initiatives from the council simply because of lack of finance.
Harry Rimmer still remembers how Michael Heseltine couldn't believe his luck when he realised that he might actually get Liverpool under his belt. All was revealed when Heseltine left the negotiating chamber.
Get me to a phone, he said to the civil servant, sir. Well, should we go back to your office? No, he said. Now, here. Get me to a phone. Well, you're due somewhere else, Minister. You know, this other... Oh, yes, I know about that, he said, but I must deal with this now. Get me to a phone. He wanted action there and then before I changed my mind.
Yeah, right.
And within a week, we'd got it, you know, sort of organised to the talking stage.
The tenants themselves also voted to opt out of council control, and the Liverpool Housing Action Trust was in place by 1993. But the HAT, as it came to be known, didn't refurbish every tower block as they had originally intended. Many of the blocks had decayed to a point where it would have cost more to repair them than to knock them down and replace them with bungalows and houses. Only a handful such as those at Sefton Park were chosen for refurbishment. 54 out of the original 67 tower blocks were demolished and tenants moved into new build on their footprints. One by one, the towers fell.
I think the first tower block we blew up, which was a very sort of brutal act, if you like, was one of the Shiel Park tower blocks in the Kensington area of Liverpool. And it happened on a Sunday, but there was quite a fanfare to it, and I think we did a press release and there was people pushing the plunger.
Well, I was asked to press the button, and it was just... The funny thing is, you can't remember the noise afterwards. There's obviously a noise, but you can't remember it afterwards. All you remember is the smoke. And the smoke just went up in the air and it looked like snow. And as it was all descending, the smoke itself, it started to come toward us. But the one thing that struck me and I thought about it was out of the smoke and walking toward me was two elderly people. And one of them was crying. And she made me nearly cry. I said, what are you crying for? She said, I thought I could hear my mum. I moved in with my mother. I can hear my mother now, Juice, and the blocks coming down. And I felt really guilty. She had memories of her mother. And I thought, and here's me pressing the button and I'm blowing it up.
But I think all the staff there at the time felt very much that there was this... It was a very sad occasion for the residents who were around watching the block coming down. And I think it was very clear that actually this wasn't appropriate to respect people's feelings and their histories. And so although we blew up tower blocks later on, we actually played it much more lower key and made it much more localised. And I think that was the right thing to do.
5 minutes to go and what stood for 35 years is about to become 7,000 tonnes of rubble. Valley View's tower block was painstakingly erected in 1964. It'll take just a couple of seconds to come down. Local residents have been moved outside a 200-metre exclusion zone. Still, best not to take any chances.
The public demolitions of tower blocks as a kind of public spectacle, I personally look on it as being a kind of surrogate public executions, that people are not allowed to see, robbers being beheaded or kind of thrown to the lions in the Colosseum or whatever anymore. And this is an equivalent, and encouraged by the polemical housing debate system in Britain, that particular types of housing are demonised and are ascribed with the ability to actually cause social ills. So the blocks become criminals, and but because they're not actually humans, it's legitimate to see them being executed. To me, there's something really unsavoury and horrible about the whole thing.
It was fantastic, actually. I could even feel the vibration. I thought it was brilliant.
There was no matches on that day and nothing was happening and nothing going on, so I thought, well, I'll go to listen to a demolition. I thought, right. So there I was, and all the people turned out, and it was quite jolly in a way, a bit sad, but it was like somebody near me said they hadn't seen that many people out since VE night. And then this noise went off, this like a gunshot, like a noise, and I thought, oh, what's happening here? Sorry, something's gone wrong. Well, all it was a scare was set off 2 minutes before the mighty explosion to give the city's pigeons a chance to escape. Well, some of them escaped, then there was this great whooshing noise, and the whole thing came down, and then there was a huge cheer, because right after all this had happened, this bedraggled, manky, battered, bludgeoned bird rose up out of the dust, and you could easily say that that was Liverpool Resurgent, couldn't you, as this pigeon battled its way out of the mess.
Enjoy yourself, there's lots to see and hear. When you log on to Tenantspin, you'll never shed a tear.
One of the most innovative ways of drawing together tenants from across all the city's beleaguered tower blocks was Tenantspin, an internet broadcasting project that began in 1999.
Doing sound? John?
John?
Right, counting down from 5, 4, 3, 2... One, and
we get interested in each other's blocks, what your block do and what my block don't do and that sort of thing, and it sort of brings us more or less together. We solve each other's problems in our own little way.
The Liverpool Housing Action Trust developed the idea with FACT, the Foundation for Art and Creative Technology, and tenants were trained to become producers, technicians and presenters. Their programming schedule roughly falls into two parts. The bi-weekly shows about ever-present housing issues, where professionals in this field are thoroughly quizzed, and more ambitious schemes. They've chosen to work with writers, musicians, filmmakers and sound recordists in a collaborative exercise about the experience of high-rise living. Paul Kelly was responsible for community development within the Housing Action Trust.
It emerged from our desire to get behind the front doors of people living in the tower blocks, and we really wanted people to vocalise their views about what we were going to do to their particular tower block and to engage in the process. And we had used lots of different methods and then started to develop into the working with artists and the arts organisations in the city. And what we found was it really gave people a confidence in sharing their views in a really open and honest way. They felt there was no, you know, we couldn't control the agenda. We were very much saying to people, look, here's the tools here. And it triggered something in people.
Welcome to Tenantspin's Afternoon Architecture Review, which I won't be saying again in a hurry. And I'm delighted to be joined here
today. The output from all Tenantspin endeavours has been diligently archived and put onto the net. And just by roaming around their website, there's an eclectic mix of material to listen to.
A major flaw. The thing was ugly.
U-G-L-Y. It's a four-letter word, and it really was ugly. And St George's Hall, by no stretch of the
Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Billy.
Just recently, I'm finding that I can't relate to things. I can't relate to the world. I just suddenly seem to have come to the realisation that where's it all gone? What's happened?
We'll just have a go.
Where's my life gone?
You can join in if you want. You just say that you're here.
Yeah.
Just say that you're
here. Yeah, don't forget it out of it. You're singing.
What do you do in this winter? Are you staying home and feeling blue?
One of the most interesting tenant spin projects to arise out of the whole demolition programme was a play called Superblock that was eventually broadcast on BBC Radio 3. The writer, Jeff Young, spent 18 months working with tenants and building their thoughts and experiences into the script. Set in the year 2040, Superblock begins as a vision dreamt up by an architect to build a single 1,470-storey tower block from the salvaged concrete and bricks of all the high-rises that had just been demolished in Liverpool.
It's a mixture of an elegy and an epitaph. What would happen to the people who went to live in that place?
Out of the rubble, a superblock grew. I will hold my breath with the wonder of it all. To build a tower block that contained a city. To build a tower block that contained the world. 67 tower blocks stacked to the moon. And when people came to live here, you could see it in their faces. A look of awe. Yet awe is kin to fear.
We went to see one of the Liverpool tower blocks being demolished. And we went into the local school playground to watch this, and there was a small boy who was playing on a hopscotch grid that was drawn on the school playground. He was hopping and skipping across these numbers in a very old, you know, old-fashioned kind of way. The demolition was counted down, and then the building collapsed. And all the way through this moment, this boy didn't even see the building coming down. He was looking at us because we had a posh camera. The actual photograph was seconds before the building collapsed, so it looks like the building is still standing. And this boy is just staring into the camera, and he's like he could be a ghost. And he became a character in the piece, and there's something always fascinating for me between the encounter of children and old people, and I just married two ideas and two notions, two different voices together, talking about this monstrous building that they now, in their different ways, haunt.
I was a boy in a playground. There were crowds all around. It was the day of the demolition. I was small. I drew the hopscotch court on the ground and told people all around me the rules. And as I was telling them, the ground moved, and then the building bent at the belly and fell over on its knees, and its head at the floor, and it was sad. It was all over the floor like someone I once saw dying in Woolworths. And then its ghost came out of it and started crawling towards us. It fell on us. We were running. We were laughing because we were scared. And then it went quiet in slow motion. There was clapping, and a woman was in tears. She just stood there and was muttering.
The ghosts of all our lives. My God, the ghosts of everything we've lived.
She was alone, and I went up to her and gave her my bottle top. And I said to her, the building's gone. And she was hearing music.
I'd left the radio on. It was there in the living room as my home collapsed. In the middle of a tower block blown to smithereens. Nat King Cole was singing. The radio was beaten in the rubble. Oh, how sad. How beautiful. That lovely voice crooning in the building's dust. Singing unforgettable at the end of the world.
And we were in the dust and all alone.
My name's Jim Jones. I'm the chair of the High Rise Tenants Group.
and became involved in Superblock via the tenant spin project attached to the HRTG. The fantasy attached to Superblock is not that much removed from reality in any sense at all. If that 14,000-foot building is broken up into chunks and dotted around the city, then you've got exactly what we've got now.
One of the tower blocks we used in our story collecting was a tower block I used to go to when I was a kid to visit my auntie, and she died in the 1960s. We used to go, I think it was one Sunday every month. The lifts didn't work at that time, and we always used to climb up the stairs, 10 flights, up to the 10th floor. And the noises that the staircase made and the banging of doors and the wind, the most fantastic sounds you will hear are in a tower block. And people always said to us that when they lived on the ground, they hadn't even noticed, but when they lived in the sky, they were really aware of the weather.
If it was really, really windy, you got this howling sound. It's like a hollow sound on the landings. And that used to be in the loo as well. You knew if you went into the toilet in the flat, you'd sit there. And the bloody wind used to frighten the life out. I hate wind anyway, from underground outside. But the noise coming through the vents, it was like from the bottom to top and top to bottom. And the stairs, they were the same.
The wind gets into the building, you know. It's scary and it's beautiful. And what the acoustically what tends to happen is that the wind in the building blows sounds from far away and from different floors. You get strange murmurings, perhaps, or whispers, voices, or just the sound of the building itself coming through the ventilation shafts. And that fascinated me. It was like a big storage cabinet full of cassettes of documentary evidence of all these people that had lived in these buildings over time, you know.
Alan Dunn is the Tenantspin programme manager.
Part of our big emphasis is laid on not being overtly nostalgic or reminiscence project within Tenantspin. And we thought with an ageing population, what would be interesting, it's a horrible word, but what would open up more doors would be to always look forward. So Superblock intentionally was set 40 years into the future. So it was not about looking back at the whole history of social housing, but it was projecting that experience forward 40 years. And a lot of people said to me, they've never in their life been asked to look forward more than, you know, next year, 2 years at the most. So we were suddenly setting that 40 years in the future. And through that process, because it was fictional, obviously, it was science fiction in a sense, there were so many real, honest, angry, extreme opinions expressed about Turblock living because it was set in the future.
Superblock was broadcast on BBC Radio 3 in 2003. And directed by Kate Rowland. While Superblock was inspired by the internal stories, Chris Watson, who is an award-winning sound recordist, looked out from the towers over Sefton Park and began to develop the idea for another Tenantspin project called A Winter's Tale. Kath Healy lives on the 14th floor of one of the blocks, and it was the view from her flat in particular that caught Chris's imagination.
The flats had recently been refurbished, so she had this beautiful, huge, double-glazed window. And the thing I noticed, because I work in television and film, that the shape of the window was a perfect 16x9 cinema screen, cinemascope format. So it was as if there was this huge panoramic film being played of Sefton Park. And the idea just came to me straight away, because I could look out of Kath's flat and see this view, but hear nothing because of the double glazing. So I thought it would be just a really good way to use sound, would be to bring the sound of the view into people's living rooms.
Working with the residents in the dark months of 2004, Chris set off into the undergrowth with his rookie band of sound explorers and ornithologists.
We went out in the afternoon into Sefton Park. It was a really beautiful time. We were lucky with the weather because it was calm, very cold, bitingly cold. So everybody's wrapped up and we had flasks and they had the microphones, which are these tiny personal microphones that you see newsreaders wearing on television every night. So we fixed them either to either side of their ears or on hats or on jumpers or on jackets and coats, on lapels. So it was a highly portable system. We went as a group, but they would choose to go and record different things, and they literally had to walk up to it because they were wearing the microphones, stand still themselves and be quiet and just record whatever was around them. As the time went on, as the park started to shut down around 4 o'clock, as darkness started to fall, the public left the park and the other residents, the wildlife, started to take over. And the group sort of noticeably shrank together and then drifted off into dark corners of the park. There's a beautiful area behind the palm house which has rhododendron plants, and it's a favourite area for the blackbirds to roost, and that's one of my favourite pieces. We all stood as a group and everybody was recording away because the whole place was buzzing with the chinking and clattering of these blackbirds going to roost in the darkness.
We eventually got an owl, which I found.
Jean Niblock.
People were saying, oh, there's no owls about, and I said, yes, there is, just keep following down here, and we found the owl. We ended up coming across the park, and I said to Chris, by the way, we have robins that sing all night, because I live on the ninth floor, and it's like a quadrangle of sound that comes up. So, of course, he said, no. I said, yes, we have robins that don't go to sleep. They sing all night. They chatter all night.
We were stood at the time, because I'd encouraged everybody to stand underneath this particular oak tree. And I realised we could see the silhouette of the tower blocks through the blackened fingers of these leafless branches of the oaks and beeches bordering Sefton Park, illuminated by the deep orange glow of the streetlights and the security lamps on the edge of the park. And in the branches of these trees bordering the park, and literally in the moon shadow of the tower blocks, there were robins having a territorial song battle. And I was amazed that at around about midnight in December they were singing. But it's because the streetlights, the sodium streetlights, emit a range of frequencies which apparently convince the birds that it's daylight. And literally we just stood underneath these birds for several minutes and recorded this really beautiful, liquid song of these birds singing their hearts out in the middle of winter.
Once the material was gathered and edited, tenants were able to hear A Winter's Tale via the community cable network piped into the flats. Kath Healy.
I spent many hours in the dark looking out over the park, and it was really wonderful just to sit in the chair, look out over the wilderness, the lights in the park, and listen to the birds. That was fantastic.
As to where we are now, Liverpool is very much in the news. The city is preparing to be European Capital of Culture for 2008. Michael Heseltine was recently back in the city with new boy on the block, David Cameron, talking up a conservative regeneration plan. Meanwhile, demolition is planned for the so-called Welsh Streets area of Liverpool, and sleuth-like, Tenantspin has been inspecting the evidence for and against.
Well, people are quite bitter about it, on the one hand. But don't get me wrong, Kath, I try to take a balanced view.
You know, it's at the stage people haven't got the money and the property's in such bad repair. What it would cost to fix that up is more than the property is worth.
Pouring new wine into old bottles is never easy. New cities everywhere are going to cost a lot of time and a lot of money. The Beatles will be grandfathers before you can discover new Liverpool for yourself. Quality is never cheap. If we expect to buy cut-price New Jerusalems in the bargain basement, we mustn't be too surprised if they turn out to be shoddy and disappointing.
I have this great anger and sadness about Liverpool. I feel hurt when I go back there and see how it's been razed to the ground. The Germans started it, and the planners went on.
Is Liverpool one of the most demolished cities in the country?
There's a council resolution from the 18th century
which suggests that they take everything down and start again. To some extent, it's still happening. And it probably always will. This is not a solid, steady sort of a place. It's always been the next big thing.
Private high-rise apartment blocks continue to be built in the city, but as a symbol of public housing, the chapter is finished. Only the Sefton Park flats and a smattering of others remain.
For me, the skyline has lost a bit of its richness. And obviously one of the more subtle things that have been lost through the demolition process has been vantage points. So we've lost hundreds, possibly 1,000 vantage points of the city, going from 1 foot right up to the 14th floor. And people have been able to see different things at different perspectives, different angles. That's gone, and that won't come back.
Joey, why don't you say hello? Stop making a fib of me. Come on. Oh, I'll go to sleep if you want to.
Doors opening. Ground floor.
It's just turned midnight and the lights have gone out on the Anglican Cathedral. So this is the end of my day and it's Kath Healy from Sefton Park signing off. Good night.